What I want to talk to you about is the requirements for strong, sustainable telehealth programs. And as Dr. Kim said, it was a collaborative effort of the University of South Alabama and the Regional Coordinating Center for Hurricane Response. And it involved the contributions of many colleagues across these two institutions, which are the co-authors in this study. I have no disclosures. And Dr. Kim explained to you the view of telehealth, and it's important to realize that many people speak of telemedicine. However, we are trying to move into just, you know, having homogeneous terms, and telehealth seems to encompass that, as defined by HRSA, as encompassing clinical services, education, and administration. Now, the push for telehealth has several years behind it. Perhaps the strongest push for telehealth in the United States was done in the 1990s, when it was seen as a solution of access to healthcare for rural communities. So there was a lot of money invested into building telehealth, telemedicine, infrastructure, and know-how, because it was seen as one of the solutions for rural communities which have very poor telehealth access. Since then, there has been a tremendous growth in the technology for telehealth, and we have seen how Dr. MacArthur and her colleague have explained to us about very specific things that technology can do for very specific diseases. And we have also heard as how a simple telephone can truly propel healthcare in the third world. So there has been a lot of development and growth, and still we are not at the level of what Dr. Kim commented, that familiarity level, where everybody is just comfortable with telehealth. We are not there. However, we do have there is a momentum that's growing towards that stage, and the past 2 years have seen it really strongly develop. I have put here in this arrow 4 events that I believe are very strong in giving telehealth the momentum that we need to come to that level of familiarity. In 2008, there was a big meeting which tried to forecast a roadmap for the future of telehealth. Then in January of 2009, perhaps the major single element that will support telehealth is the resources that were built in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, in which there were resources built there to actually support widespread use of electronic medical records. And electronic medical records are very critical in the growth of telehealth. And that those resources were given both to the public and the private sector. So this, perhaps, when we look in retrospective, we will mark that day as one of the days that actually helped move telehealth forward. There is currently a bill in Congress, Bill House Representatives 2068. Yeah. Oh. Okay. House Representative Bill 2068, this is a bill that's still in legislative process, but it actually has a lot of elements that will move telehealth forward if it is passed. The single most important one is to define reimbursement for telehealth through Medicare, and we know that Medicare is a model that is probably going to be followed by the private sector too. So this is a very important bill that's making its way in the legislative process. And then in June of 2009, there was a big meeting convened by one of the NIH centers in which several white papers were produced regarding telehealth. But more important also, there were very important recommendations given to NIH as to how to fund for telehealth development. So I truly believe that these past 2 years have been very momentous in making telehealth move forward. So at this juncture, it is important to consider how can we use these assets that are coming to our hands to move telehealth forward. And the first thing that comes to mind is we need to look at the lessons of those pioneers that you know, came first in telehealth efforts. And I wanted to show you, this comes right across from the reference, and it is the thoughts of Dr. Dale Alverson, one of the major telehealth proponents in the 1990s, and he was charged with developing a telehealth network in New Mexico. And look at what he says. He says, in retrospect, we did not start thinking about sustainability. And we believe that our enthusiasm was going to carry us through, and we were not able to see the tremendous complexity of building a telehealth program. And those are his words. And so I believe that when we think of telehealth programs, we really need to pay heed to this kind of thought. So the study that we conducted, as Dr. Kim has mentioned, involved all the organizations that in the wake of Katrina were contacted by the RCC to see whether they could use a telehealth solution for mental health care delivery. And what we did is we asked these people about their experiences with the idea of building a shared knowledge base that could be used by other people as they are developing telehealth programs. As a qualitative research study, we interviewed people with open-ended questions, with follow-up probes, in order to get what their experiences were. And we asked questions both of people who had moved and actually have defined telehealth programs as a result of their interaction with RCC, but also those people who had been approached by RCC and had not been able to develop a telehealth program. So both views were, you know, both views from this kind, all of these people were involved. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar with qualitative research, our data is the narrative of those interviews. So the transcripts are our data, and we had, in the end, 37 of those. In order to make, you know, understand what the narrative is telling, we use codes. So in this particular case, there were 8 analysts involved, and they came from medicine, public health, medical anthropology, and business. And these 8 analysts came together and decide on the codes and what they meant. And so we had our coding list. And then each transcript was analyzed by 3 analysts. The richness of qualitative research is that everybody brings their own perspectives to the table. So whenever there is discrepancies, and by discrepancies I mean a person, an analyst might have seen this as meaning something, and another analyst will see it as meaning something different. Those are discussed, and those are all built in the end in the understanding of the transcript. So at the end of the day, we came up with consensus-coded transcripts, and that was the data that we queried to understand what these key informants were telling us. We had almost complete participation from the organizational point of view, and about 3/4 of our eligible individuals participated. You see how it's heavily weighted toward the administrative role, but there are also clinical and technical responses, and then advocacy was also, some of our key informants were advocates for telehealth. Now, the information that these key informants provided for us told us that in order to have sustainable telehealth, there have to be macro level and micro level elements. And before I give you the list of what they told us, I'd like for you to see, to be able to hear them from in their own voice. At the macro level element, you can see in the first quote that this key informant is asking, why don't we have overall planning and organizational structures for telehealth that cut across the individual efforts for implementing telehealth? Why don't we have national level guidelines and plans that would help us to do telehealth in the right way? The second quote alludes to the reimbursement issue. Reimbursement is a major problem with telehealth, and you can see how this key informant is actually pointing up to one of the distinctive characteristics of telehealth, that reimbursement must be at the site that the patient is and where the provider is. So this idea of reimbursing two sites for one service needs to be built in legislation for telehealth reimbursement. This quote I like because it actually tackles two major ideas. You see at the beginning the idea of technology and transmission standards, and towards the end, the idea of standards for the quality of service. So those are also constructs that need to be universal. Not everybody should be doing telehealth the way they think it works, but the way telehealth should work. So this is a macro level issue. And here are the six recommendations for telehealth sustainability from our key informants. There has to be some level of governmental regulation or guidelines. There have to be legal and financial relationships defined. The infrastructure, broadband connectivity, and maintenance of that infrastructure is also a macro level theme. They have to be standards for the compatibility of systems and also for the measurement of quality of care. Networking among programs was considered very important. There is several examples of telehealth programs that have already happened, and being able to have readily available information on protocols and procedures would be very valuable. And then finally, this idea of selling telehealth to the public is not, it's yes, a local issue, but it's also a national level issue. So they consider this a macro level element. Now, with regard to the micro level element, many of our key informants told us we jumped into this and we really had not thought it through. So if you look at the second quote, a good vision and a good plan. And if you look at the bottom of that quote, what's the vision and what are you trying to accomplish? What are your objectives? So this is seminal in implementing a program to have a clear idea of what your outcomes are going to be. And the quote on top I like because we who are in telehealth tend to think that technology is the answer. But this key informant actually says, yes, technology is a problem, but it's not the main problem, it's the process. Once you bring telehealth into an operation, how do you change that operation to harbor telehealth? And that is more difficult than buying, you know, the latest technology. It's very difficult to maintain it from the technology point of view, but that's not the biggest issue. The biggest issue is incorporate the process. Now, the second quote at the bottom, I bring to you because this is a successful telehealth person that has actually come to a local arrangement that works for him and for his constituents. This is an academic center in a university that's actually providing emergency support to emergency care to rural clinics. And how did they fund this? Well, their particular strategy was to charge not per encounter, but to charge per hour. And that worked for them and for the providers in the rural clinics. There were eight elements that our key informants identified. Start with a plan. Think of the cost. It's necessary that the institution actually adopts telehealth with organizational policies and procedures and protocols specific to telehealth. It's necessary for the organization to really be invested, understand that this will be good for them and for their organization, and more importantly, for their patients. There is necessary training specific to telehealth, not only for the healthcare provider, but also for the clerk. Clerks are being asked now to schedule appointments for people in their site with the provider outside. So that brings another level of complexity to their job. So there has to be training at all levels specific to telehealth. There have to be equipment and facilities that are appropriate. Technical support is important, otherwise telehealth use is discouraged. There has to be marketing to the patients, to the public, and then at the local level, at the state level, at the regional level, partnerships, so that telehealth providers can learn from what other people are doing in their closed area. This would also be helpful, they explain, because then you would have like a net where if your particular operation is not functioning, you can refer the patient to another place or to another telehealth provider. So those were important recommendations from our key informants. And for us, hopefully, who are proponents and advocates of telehealth, I think this quote is very important. Because for us, telehealth is the first item in our agenda, but for the institutions that are dealing with medical care to the underserved, it's not the first item in their agenda. They are overworked to begin with. They have issues of not having enough personnel, enough resources, and here we come, techie enthusiasts, trying to tell them that they need to transform into this telehealth or they have to incorporate telehealth, and that's not in their agenda. So if we are to propose a telehealth program, if we're going to be strong advocates for telehealth, we need to understand that they have other agendas and we just need to accommodate and work with them. As conclusions of our work, first of all, if you are a proponent of a telehealth program or if you are moving in that direction, think sustainability first. What is interesting is that all those elements that I have shown you are the elements that the experts propose in white papers. So it's very encouraging to see that from the field, those constructs are being supported. However, when talking to people in the field, the words of their peers may resonate better than just handing them a white paper. And also, I believe that just as those quotes clearly convey thoughts for you, they can be a strong element when we advocate for national level support to telehealth. There's nothing like hearing it from somebody who's worked with it. The first quote tells you what this person thought. All the things that we had to arrange or think about when we were implementing our telehealth program. And in the second quote, if we are advocating for telehealth, this is a good quote to let people know that training is very important. And finally, as conclusions for our work, we believe that this shared knowledge base brings us a bit forward in the experience of telehealth implementation, because as Dr. Kim just mentioned, in the past we have had references to individual programs and their successes and challenges, but this is the collective experience of 37 people. And in that sense, it actually, I think, provides a step forward into that idea of bringing telehealth to be a familiar issue. And then again, it's important that what we found from the bottom up actually validates what's trying to be fed into people from the top down. And my last slide is just the acknowledgments to the institutions that participated. Special thanks to the administrator of this project, Crystal Kinnard, who did an excellent job, and then an acknowledgement of our funding source. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank all of our speakers. We now have about 15 minutes for questions. I'd like you to stand up, ask your question, and direct it to somebody. I'm going to ask that whoever the question is directed to step up to the mic for the purposes of the recording of this session. So, yes, sir.
I don't know if you can hear me, my voice is not good. I always have to use the mic. I like what you're saying, that's why I wanted to use the mic. One aspect that is interesting is if they are receiving calls for free, so the free workers won't mind because they won't get charged. Because otherwise they won't put up the call, just an FYI. The other is, off late I've seen several phone companies making be on a separate language, the kind of leadership, because on 9-1, if they watch the district, they will learn the feeling. I think that would make a big difference.
Yes, but the Hindi version at the moment has not been versatile and it's creating a lot of problems. Being experimented, but all the systems are not supported.
Yeah, I had a very basic mobile as well.
No, I'm not saying the mobile system. Is a,
no, the I never say that. So for texting, all my contacts were in Hindi. And maybe our threshold is there, but I understand it's not as good as for English. I had only like $50, $10.
And I think that if I could provide sort of a contextual comment, I am fascinated about the things that are happening in India, and actually I'm fascinated by things that are happening outside of the U.S. because I think it's important to recognize that the growth and development of technologies when comparing the U.S. And other parts of the world are markedly different. So in places like India, and particularly I have friends and colleagues who work in sub-Saharan Africa, cellular technologies have provided a lot of these countries to leapfrog over a lot of the time and expense that we've had to sort of cobble together over many, many decades. So the idea of using POTS lines and then progressing to coax cable and out of fiber, there are going to be a bunch of people who are effectively leapfrogging over us. And are going to be deploying. And so having an attention to what's happening outside the U.S. is going to be extraordinarily important because hopefully I think that there are going to be solutions that are going to be developed out there. The other comment that I would have in the U.S. versus international comparison is how much of a how the U.S. is, in my words, being persecuted by the telecom companies. I think it's an atrocity how much we pay for broadband connectivity. And it's entirely managed by this stuff, where there are countries in Europe that actually view broadband as a right. I don't know that I would go that far. Citywide clouds in Tokyo and other places are remarkable achievements. And so I'm so thrilled to hear about the Pecan Park initiative. It makes sense to be able to push out a Wi-Fi cloud, minimal expense, and potentially support an at-risk population in some extraordinary ways. So I think that's some fantastic stuff. Any other questions? Absolutely. Yes?
I really enjoyed all your presentations, and I have two questions for you tonight. The first, and the two speakers, I was wondering if your role in the design was just awareness or perception or both, and how those specific goals influence your UI design and information presentation. And then my second question is for Dr. Kim. I appreciate
those are two exceptionally thoughtful questions. I'm going to let you guys come and answer your question first, and then I can speak to the second.
So thank you for your question, and it does have a central aspect of what we were doing was definitely informing the population, and it wasn't that. Like we said, it wasn't a top-down type deal where we were pushing information. We were getting informed just as much as they were about chronic disease and chronic disease management through the CBPR model. So I think the primary focus of what we were doing was more about informing in this early stage, and through this reciprocal knowledge transfer, I think we were able to design a much better device. Ultimately, I think that to get real results, there has to be a component of persuasion for sure, because even if we understand each other, there still has to be buy-in. And there was aspects of that when we did the first intervention with the diabetes intervention where initially it was about bringing mothers through the parent-teacher organizations together to talk about, you know, what is diabetes, what are some of the core principles behind it in terms of what you can eat and whatnot. But the, by the end, what really got, I think, some momentum going was the persuasion, the buy-in that happened. And then there was healthy eating courses that were sort of naturally occurring out of this parent-teacher organization community-based participatory research. So I think you're right in that, you know, it's probably a dual-step system where the first step is information transfer, of course, and then both sides can persuade each other to get to the more coalition end.
Okay, the short answer to your question. There has been and will continue to be an emerging data set that talks about the equivalence or the inefficacy of traditional versus telehealth interventions. And so ultimately, both in the research and in my own personal experience, while different, I do believe that they're equivalent. Now, is it the same? Absolutely not. And that gets back to my idea that just because you can doesn't necessarily mean you should. So I'm certainly not advocating that everybody run out and find their own teletherapist or telecardiologist. What I am saying, though, is that my enthusiasm is born out of a belief that I actually believe that a medical apocalypse is coming, that our system is so untenable that we need to make big moves in order to change how it is that we care for each other. And through the sort of wading through this apocalypse, I am sort of in the process of forging how I, as a doctor, can best serve a population, specifically an at-risk or vulnerable population. And I believe that the one-on-one encounter, the sort of the traditional sense of a patient seeing a doctor, is actually going to be less is going to play less prominent a role in tomorrow's healthcare model. I think that we as providers should be responsible for populations. And with the advent of health information technology and the massive amounts of data that's going to be out there, we need to be able to look at a population of people and be able to effectively and efficiently, you know, find the ones that are ticking up and be able to, you know, direct resources in that way. And so I think telehealth is going to play a huge role in that. And so if you can think about it, while I continue to model my clinical practice after traditional sort of interventions in my detention center clinic, I'm actually in the process of coming up with a different way of doing this. Rather than seeing the kids one at a time as they come in, I want to create a screening and surveillance program and then group them. These are the folks that have primarily mood disorders. These are the folks with primarily behavioral disorders. These are the sexual trauma kids. And as a group, sort of talk through the sort of the interventions. It's a work in progress. It's sort of a difficult thing. I'm the first to admit that I'm so far on a branch. My parents and everybody I work with are sort of looking at me going, what, you're a doctor? What? I don't get it. But I remain very optimistic because every time I sort of work at this thing that I do, I meet extraordinary people who seem to agree. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Dr. Kim, my background is teaching innovation and care about innovation. The one thing that's important in that kind of work is understanding and recognizing analogies, maybe across the distance. So my question is, for you and the rest of the panelists, what trends or analogies outside of the health sphere have been meaningful to you as you work on the cutting edge yourself?
That's a very good question. Would anybody care to respond? I think about that all the time. And I was actually meeting with a good friend and colleague, Aziz Nuruddin, who was one of the early contributors to the RCC effort. She herself is a teacher who's now moving into the public health space, and she works for the health commissioner of Richmond, Virginia. In her CDC fellowship, she's going to be a name. Definitely look out for her one day. I as you can sort of tell from my presentation, I use very few words, and I try to do it through storytelling, and I guess that my take would be that I find the most pervasive and the most compelling ways to convey this admittedly sort of weird way of taking care of people is through stories. Now, anecdotal, you know, persuasion will only get you so far, and so you will need some sort of data, but rather than sort of ramble on, we could talk sort of after the fact, because I've got tons to talk, Edward Tufte, in a variety of different ways to sort of present data and stuff like that, that we live in exciting times. Technology is, as I mentioned, providing us with so much information and data. I think that in the end, we're going to find some extraordinarily transformative ways to come together. I'll leave you with one example. I was talking to Aziza. I recently encountered a group that culled a whole bunch of tweets. Who knows what a tweet is? Everyone? Does anybody not know what a tweet is? Good. Okay. So they culled, I don't know how many countless tweets across the country, specifically looking for mood comments. And they graphed using a U.S. Sort of silhouette and sort of morphing it so that the concentrations would accentuate that part of the country over time, showing where and when we are most happy and most sad. And I was like, I'm not exactly sure what we're going to do with something like that, but I find that to be, you know, it sort of inspires me to rethink the way that we sort of look at ourselves as a people, that, you know, it's not that just poor minorities are sad, but that this is a dynamic flowing thing that changes depending on your geography and time of day. So, any other questions? Yes.
Actually, in this effort, and I think Dr. Kim will agree with me on this, we actually looked, and actually he looked, because I came in at the back end of this project, he looked for people who were already attuned to telehealth. And our major, you know, the provider that perhaps had the most success was a person who was already doing telehealth on his own, in a different location. So in this particular, in the component of the provider, I believe we did not have that much of a training issue. But on the actual people who were going to deliver to help the patients on the local end to connect with the distant providers, unfortunately, it was basically training on the job. And I really, I mean, that was, if you imagine Katrina, it was really a war conditions. I mean, people rose up and did things that they wouldn't have done on every day just because they saw such a strong need. So I wouldn't recommend that model for the future. And in fact, one of the things that I particularly have learned from this effort is that we need to start training the telehealth providers today. So, you know, on a regular person's training as an LPN, as a clerk, as a nurse, as a physician, there should be in the curriculum specific components that speak to telehealth functions. Luckily, I view myself as being part of the interface generation in that I did not grow up with technology. I have reasonably adopted it, and I want to move it forward. But my kids, and probably many of you, have grown up with technology. So it's not going to be as difficult for the new generations to be trained in telehealth capacities because, you know, instant messaging, tweets, that kind of a thing is so a part of this new generation that it's not going to be so much an issue. But I think there are things specific to telehealth that have to be incorporated in the curriculum of any healthcare provider from the, you know, the front-end administrative personnel to the physician. I actually saw that there is now a career in telehealth program management. It does exist, and there are universities who are doing it. So I think I am not the one to tell you what exactly has to be done, but I know that there are people who are thinking about it and actually developing curriculums. Would you like to expand?
Just to echo what Dr. Arya said, that ultimately my take on sort of policies and procedures, they're extraordinarily important. in my work with the RCC and through the Gulf, because of the situation, post-disaster, stuff like that, and not trying to saddle them with sort of new work, my approach was kind of straightforward. I said, so what are your current policies and procedures? And they would sort of lay it out. And I would do my best to sort of construct a telehealth workflow that most closely mirrored what they ordinarily do. And just a little bit of thoughtfulness, that can be done pretty much across the board. There are a couple of accommodations that you'll have to make. There are a couple of sort of novel protocols with regard to emergency responsiveness. I think it's important that, you know, you won't have a traditional what happens when the technology fails or what happens if the power goes out and stuff like that, that we all are going to have to do as high tech gets us all towards an electronic health record. One of the things that I hear sort of in the ether of the interweb is that you've got a lot of hopped up doctors who are concerned about a wide variety of things, most of which are justified, but ultimately it comes down to behavioral change. And you know, a number of our panelists talk about the fact that, you know, even if it's, you know, it makes sense to you or it makes sense to the organization, there's always going to be people who are going to fight it just because that's just the nature of the beast, and it requires persistence. So most of the people that I work with, I usually, you know, sort of indoctrinate them by saying, okay, you ready to strap on a helmet and run at a wall? Because that's pretty much what it's like.